Hello everyone, you're listening to Poetry, the Memoir of the Soul. I'm Barbara Lanehart, your host and poet in residence. The table is set, come on in. Join me for some tea and coffee. It's just you and me today. Settle in for some poetry and prose. How are you doing? I hope you're staying well this winter. No colds or flu, I hope. It's going around. Did you get a flu shot? I sure did, but I know many people avoid vaccinations due to feared side effects. Some believe the flu vaccine contributes to Alzheimer's despite research providing information on the, argument against that. Here's the problem. The controversy that has arisen over vaccines has been on my mind lately, because we're now faced with the rapid spread of the coronavirus COVID-19, for which we currently have no immunization. Health officials warn that we're very likely to contract the contagion, but I heard that it will take at least a year and a half for a vaccine to be developed and tested. Imagine the consequences of the spread of this virus without a vaccine. No doubt our lives will be greatly altered by this virus. But this memoir is not about COVID-19. It's about my miraculous and rare recovery from measles encephalitis. I feel it is important for me to share my experience with this condition because of the great controversy over the measles vaccine these days. Far too many children are not getting vaccinated against measles owing to perceived risks, so now measles has returned as a virulent threat worldwide, just as the coronavirus is. One major argument against the measles vaccine is the fear of autism. According to QJM, it's a journal, in 2015. It reports that a study led by Andrew Wakefield claims this link, but several subsequent scientific studies have proven otherwise. Because the original article was based on faulty research, Wakefield lost his medical license, and the medical journal pulled the article he wrote. Still, the fear Wakefield instigated continues to persuade people to avoid vaccines, especially the MMR. This is from an article in QJM called Measles-Induced Encephalitis by D.L. Fisher et al. It's in the March 2015 issue in volume 108. Also, some people may not realize the importance of the vaccine, just not have awareness, or may be experiencing conflicts in their countries that prevent access to vaccinations. Because of the controversy over the MMR vaccine, the number of cases of measles infections has risen since 2016, according to WHO, at who.int. In 2016, there were 90,000 cases, but in mid-November 2019, there were 413,000 cases, up from 90,000 cases in 2016. The MMR vaccination has helped to save over 21 million lives, and the number of measles deaths has fallen by 80% since 2000. However, the CDC reports that the number of cases of measles is on the rise in multiple countries reporting outbreaks. It's reported that 90% of those who have not been vaccinated will contract measles after exposure. And in developing countries, one out of every 100 children who have measles will die from the illness or complications such as encephalitis or pneumonia, according to the CDC at cdc.gov. In 1957, my parents were not faced with a choice about vaccinating us against measles because there was no vaccine at the time. It wasn't developed until 1963. My siblings and I contracted the virus that summer, 1957. While their illness took a benign course, I developed encephalitis with my case of the measles. Encephalitis sets in during the rash period of the case of measles or by brain inflammation following the measles infection. Symptoms include fever, headache, an altered state of consciousness, behavioral disturbances, disorientation, speech disturbances like I just had, seizures, nausea, vomiting, and paralysis. Measles encephalitis is potentially fatal, according to the Encephalitis Society at encephalitis.info. I have often contemplated my battle with measles encephalitis because it did indeed nearly kill me. According to the Encephalitis Society, 1 in 3 in 1,000 children with measles will develop encephalitis, so 1 in 3 out of 1,000 will get it. And only 85 to 90% of those children will survive, and 25% will suffer permanent neurological damage. Moreover, 1 in 1,000 children with measles will develop post-infectious encephalitis. Parents fear their children may contract encephalitis from the vaccine, but only 1 or 2 in 1,000,000 children do, and this rate is lower than that of all cases of encephalitis, according to the Encephalitis Society. Let me tell you about the illness. I would like to share my story, my memoir of how this illness manifested and affected me. I hope it will inform parents of the consequences that can develop in their young children, those at the highest risk for encephalitis. The onset of the illness happened suddenly. I turned from an active 6-year-old to a helpless baby overnight. It was the summer of 1957, and we were living in Lewistown, Montana. And so, like I said, my siblings and I all fell ill. One day, Mom asked me to run upstairs and fetch something off her dresser. I pranced up the stairs, and once I arrived in the master bedroom, my legs gave out from under me. I couldn't stand or walk, no matter how hard I tried. I managed to drag my body to the stairs and descend on my bottom step by step. Mom thought I was teasing, but then it became clear I was unable to walk. My next memory is being carried up and down the stairs for bed or baths. I can't remember the complete timeline, but I soon lost my ability to reach my arms out the full extent. I couldn't feed myself or swallow well, so I was fed baby food. I lost my ability to speak. It was very frustrating to hear in my mind exactly what I wanted to say in perfect English, but all that I could do was mutter gibberish. It must have been arduous to keep carrying me, so I remained in the living room couch. The living room became my bedroom, my dining room, and my playroom, except I couldn't play with anybody. All I could do was sleep or daydream while the family went on with their lives around me. There was no television either. It felt like an eternity lying there and trying to ask for things. But my words, as I said, were just slurred utterances like baby babble. Because no one understood me, I felt abandoned on the couch and at everyone's mercy. Mom's father was a doctor, so maybe he told her to do this. She made a tent of blankets and put me inside with a steamer. The steam helped break up the mucus enough for me to spit it out. Maybe this saved my life. At the time, I just complied because I had no strength to protest being hopeless and helpless and having to spit up phlegm into a bucket inside a makeshift tent of blankets like a lonely cell. Throughout this dark period in my young life, I felt frustrated, vulnerable, scared, and lonely. No one knew what was wrong at this point, and I wondered if this was my end of days. Finally, after a period of time, my parents came rushing home and swept me up to take me to the hospital in Miles City, Montana, where my paternal grandfather was dying. I must have been going in and out of a coma. That night, once we arrived to the hospital in Miles City, I thought I was taken to see my grandpa, who was at the same hospital. It would be the last time I would see him. These were precious moments since he was so important to me. However, if I was in a coma, why would my parents be taking me to his room instead of the ER? And if I couldn't walk, why do I recall walking? And if I couldn't stand, why do I recall standing next to him or even talking to him? Maybe we were both in a coma. More on this later. The next thing I remember is waking up from the coma. I was told it lasted 30 days, but maybe that was the complete time frame of the illness. I was surrounded by doctors and nurses. I felt what I thought were 1,000 needles sticking into my legs. A doctor said, "Say the bear went over the mountain." I must have looked confused, so he repeated, "Say the bear went over the mountain." I said, "The bear went over the mountain." There were loud cheers. "She'll be okay," he said. But I wasn't okay. I still couldn't walk. My legs felt like lead extensions. Again, I felt helpless, scared, and frustrated. Mom stayed with me as much as she could while I was in the hospital. Although I was able to ask for things and eat, I felt frightened being left alone in a hospital room for strangers who would enter my room uninvited and fuss over me. The nurses were nice, except for one who was impatient and plopped me on the toilet angrily one day. She left me sitting there a very long time. My hospital stay taught me how vulnerable and open to abuse people with disabilities are. Finally, I was able to return home, but still in a wheelchair. The doctor said I would never walk again. And there was nothing like physical therapy back then. If so, I would have been taken to a clinic for rehab. But no one doubted the words of the doctors anyway. I felt mixed emotions. Being in the wheelchair gave me a lot of attention in the hospital, and once I arrived home, there were friends of my parents there with many gifts. I even received a Darlene tea set, something I'd always wanted. Though I loved the toys, these huge, tall people loomed over me as they fussed over my sweet, helpless, now 7-year-old self. I felt diminished, ready to be stepped on or tripped over at any time. Their sympathy mixed with my feelings of helplessness made a dark emotional stew for me. I could be easily spoiled. As a minister's daughter, I would be lavished with attention at church, but I felt very lonely. Another benefit I realized was that I was off the hook for doing chores. I no longer was expected to clean out the bedrooms and do my dishes. On the other hand, once the attention calmed down, the living room again became my prison where I sat alone, since all my siblings and friends had legs and could play outside. Again, I watched life go on around me outside the picture window in the living room. Also, I continued to feel unsafe. Mom and Dad had to drive from Montana to Michigan to close up Dad's family home. While they were gone, there was news of a pedophile trying to abduct kids. As a result, Mrs. Bunker, our elderly babysitter, kept a gun. I thought about how I couldn't run from anything because I was anchored to that wheelchair. The entire experience left me anxious and vulnerable. I had a turning point. No matter how much attention and gifts I received, I came to realize that being paralyzed in a wheelchair was not the life for me. No one came to play. School's back in session and other kids had lives. Life was pretty boring and lonely. I knew that I just had to regain my independence regardless of the doctor's prognosis, that I would remain disabled in a wheelchair my entire life. I vowed to change my thinking and my fate. No one was going to tell me to stay in this wheelchair. This change in thought changed my reality, my health, and my entire life. I'm not sure how long it took, maybe a few days while my parents were away, but I taught myself how to walk again. I used my arms to push myself up so that I could slide off the wheelchair and drag my little body to a chair or to the couch. Then I would strain to pull myself up. Although it was difficult at first, I became stronger. I learned how to crawl and eventually stand. Once I could stand, I was able to walk like a miniature Frankenstein from one piece of furniture to another until I was walking more smoothly. When Mom and Dad arrived home from their depressing trip closing down their dad's family home, my dad's dad's family home, their little girl was able to run up to them. So this was an epiphany for me. This life experience taught me a great deal. The greatest realization was that I could change my destiny. I could do it. I had every reason to remain in the wheelchair because of the attention, sympathy, and love that not only I, but also my parents received because of their poor little girl. The attention from others could not offset the loneliness, the feelings of being a diminutive person and helpless, and also the boredom. I thought a lot about my choice to teach myself how to walk again. Let's face it, it's easy to think fatalistically and accept an outcome without debating it. After all, the doctor told me I was destined to use that chair for the rest of my life. And with my mom's dad being a highly respected surgeon in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, we learned not to doubt what a doctor says. He would even refuse to see patients who didn't follow his advice. Even the Mayo Clinic knew of Dr. Benjamin Titus Montgomery. A person from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, who sought help at Mayo Clinic was told, "Why are you coming here? You have Dr. Montgomery." However, in all the time I had to think, it seemed unfair for me to have to live that way. People tried to convince me with the toys, dolls, and tea sets that this condition had amenities. I was so delighted to be the princess, and yet my heart was crying out to be whole. That is why I made a different choice and threw myself off that chair. I made a choice. I learned how badly my life could have gone several years later when we were living back in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Mom and I helped give physical therapy to a young boy who didn't survive measles encephalitis like I did. He was left with permanent neurological damage, paralysis, and loss of speech. We would move his arms and legs back and forth, a method called pattern practice, that's what I was told. He would never regain full function due to the extensive neurological damage. While I was volunteering to help this boy, I suffered survivor's guilt, not understanding why I was able to recover and he wasn't. Maybe it was because he was much younger than I was when I was sick. Maybe I had a milder case. Maybe encephalitis resolves itself in some cases. Maybe I was spared because Dad was facing so much loss. His mother had died exactly 1 year earlier, and he was losing his father. And that takes me back to the last visit with my paternal grandfather in the hospital. Maybe what I thought was a real visit to my grandfather was a dream. Or maybe it was a near-death experience. Excuse me. There is speculation that the soul travels when people are in comas. Maybe he and I were both in a coma. Maybe I was about to die, and he certainly was. I recall 3 to 5 strangers with us in the hospital room. I wanted to go with Grandpa, but they told me I had to return to my room. I pleaded and pleaded, but the group of people in the room explained I couldn't remain there. This exchange went on back and forth until I woke up from my coma. Like I said earlier, if I was in a coma, why would my parents be taking me to Grandpa's room instead of the ER? And if I couldn't talk, why do I recall talking? And if I couldn't stand, why do I recall standing next to him? For years, this memory has been on my mind, but I didn't realize the import of it until I took time to do some memoir writing about it. It finally sunk in that I met with a spiritual counsel who told me that it wasn't my time to die. I think my grandfather asked that I be spared, which led to my complete healing. I'll never really know the answers in this life. However, I do know the decision to walk again involved a choice. I could have chosen to remain in the wheelchair. No one expected that to change, not the doctor, not my parents, not society. My thinking, my belief was that I could walk, and so I set out to do that. Perhaps I had support from the spiritual realm, from some bargain made to spare me. Maybe just my fire of desire to be healed and whole got me out of that chair. The experience inspired this poem. I call it Hope Was Not a Loss. My body was a cage with only eyes for doors. My arms contorted like branches twisted in shadows. Voices, hollow sounds called from the dinner table, but my legs, dead trunks, held me to a bed with a view to other children. How they danced like pansies and violets, their blooms outstretched, gathering rays for grace, but not for the night of storm clashing in my bones. My lips held back the truth. My cries were muffled in my throat. Each wail, the language of stones falling on deaf ears. Mother spoke the tunes of clouds. Her words carried her young to the stars, not to the dead rocks lining the bed of flowers that could be me. Rocks and earth held down this young one with muted cries. I am still here, in here. Don't forget the light inside this bud afflicted with blight. How I want to burst out of this stiff casing, to stretch my arms and fingers like tiny leaves unfolding in dawn. I am stuck in mud, too dense for birth, too turbid for food. No gardener is churning the soil to give me air. I was buried under new blooms, dressed in violet and pink swaddling, dancing on my grave and beckoning. Come and play, the day is divine. And so I clawed my way out of the stiff core, muck and stone, and peered into light, blinding my infant eyes. My arms and fingers unfolded into new green. My tiny legs stretched into roots, holding my core as it danced in breezes, carrying buoyant rays like waves hitting my face. Is birth a choice, or is spirit's breath irascible in creation? Can a flower remain a seed forever, or does it cast its casing aside in a mighty battle to forage life? The seed knows choice, its soul has will. For some, the earth's bed is always home. For this one, hope was not a loss. Hope was not a loss. This poem shows my recovery was as fierce as creation, because my desire to walk again was akin to the force contained inside the flower seed exploding into bloom. Indeed, I was deeply changed by this event. A new identity emerged, a new view of life and of my own power to heal myself. And if you get anything from this podcast, it is this: the power to change your thinking in order to heal. In essence, it is the power to call back your spirit from a dark place. Measles can be abated with a vaccine. Unvaccinated people who contract measles can spread the disease to people who have compromised immune systems. Also, even though encephalitis may be rare, we don't want to risk the future health and well-being of others by putting them at risk for measles and possibly encephalitis. It is not fun, let me tell you. The image I chose for this podcast shows myself at 5 years old smiling over a birthday cake, not knowing that a year later she would be fighting for her life. However, don't think about me. My recovery was rare, a miracle, as my dad said in his own memoir. Think about the sweet boy I described earlier who didn't survive measles encephalitis as a whole person. The neurological damage to his brain completely debilitated him, requiring round-the-clock physical therapy and care. His body remained a cage. And I think at this time, with the fear of the COVID-19 coronavirus, we all need to see that if we subdue our fears and make good choices, our immune systems are better off. We can remain healthy with positive thinking and actions, such as washing the hands frequently, staying home during an outbreak, using effective respiratory hygiene, seeking medical help early if we have symptoms, and following other measures found on the World Health Organization website or the CDC. And as I end the podcast, let me say, may you remain safe and healthy. May you be protected from the deadly viruses I described by choosing to follow safety measures, such as getting vaccinated, if possible. May you recognize that you have the power to heal yourself in all ways. May you know that you can call back your spirit, your power, from a dark place. Thank you for listening. This is Poetry, the Memoir of the Soul with Barbara Leonhard, host, writer, producer. You can find my poetry on WordPress at extraordinarysunshineweaver.blog. I shared my poem, Hope Was Not a Loss. You can find more research and science on measles and measles encephalitis at the Encephalitis Society online. www.encephalitis.info/measles-infection-and-encephalitis. For more information on the faulty research connecting autism with measles, see the wikipedia.org article on Andrew Wakefield. Also, www.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov under PMC articles, PMC 313-6032. It'll come up if you Google it. You can find information on COVID-19 on the World Health Organization website and the CDC. If you would like to contribute poetry to this podcast, please submit it to me in a Word document attached in an email to me at milosmom@gmail.com. On the subject line, indicate it is a submission to this podcast. I can fit it into a theme. In the email, include any pertinent information on yourself and publications you want me to promote, especially for the work submitted. And thank you again, everyone, for joining me. Just leave your cup on the table. I'll take care of it. I hope you stop by again for a visit next time on Poetry, the Memoir of the Soul. You will always have a friend here. Remember that you too can write your own poetic memoir.